We're told in the Gospels that Jesus spoke those very words to a man whose son was sick. He said, "Only believe and all things are possible." And the man said, "I believe, Lord, help thou my unbelief," and his son was healed. On another occasion, he told a man whose little daughter was sick unto death, "Believe. Believe and your child can be healed." And she was. And again throughout the Bible, and most especially throughout Jesus' teachings, in his biographies in the Bible, the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he tells us over and over again about the power of belief, that anything can be done if we believe. He also talks about the power of disbelief. When miracles don't happen, it's in situations where people have trouble believing for one reason or another. So Jesus, and of course in unity for the last century or so, we all have taught the power of believing. But it's taken secular society a little longer to catch on, but they've begun. Beginning in the 1960s especially, modern psychology has started to pick up on at least a little bit of the power of belief. And while I feel we understand it in religion a whole lot better, that psychology is just scratching the surface, some contemporary psychologists have given us some insights that we can use in religion to help us better understand how belief works. The Bible assures us it does work, but how do we make it work? How does that dynamic function in our soul, in our psyche? I think the psychologist that had the greatest insight into that was a man named Albert Ellis, one of the founders, probably the principal founder, of modern cognitive therapy, thinking therapy. My wife Faye and I were blessed to actually have some training with Albert Ellis. And while I think Albert prides himself on being the most irreverent of all men, this particular reverend found it quite enlightening, found his works quite enlightening. And one of the most enlightening things was the simple way he has of explaining how belief functions in our world, in our lives. He said, understanding how belief works is as simple as understanding your ABCs. In this model, in Ellis's model, A stands for, well, A can be for activating event, or whatever it was in life that called us to A for action. Something happened, somebody said something, whatever gets us moving, whatever stimulates a reaction on our part. C, well, in Ellis's model, C stands for the consequence, our reaction, our response to A's stimulus. How we feel and what we do as a result. How we feel as a consequence of what happened, and then what we do as a result of how we feel. But just as in the alphabet, in life, something comes between A and C. B, and B stands for belief. And B not only goes between A and C, belief is the go-between that stands between the events that activate our actions and our emotions and those actual feelings that are a consequence themselves. Now, we don't always recognize that this is taking place, but in every situation, Ellis assures us, when something happens, belief gets involved. It's really our beliefs that push the buttons. Our beliefs that control our ultimate feeling and then response. And we have a lot of beliefs. You know, some people collect stamps. Other people collect antiques or bric-a-brac. My mother collected things that collected dust. That seemed to be the only qualification. She loved things that collected dust. She had an unlimited supply of these. But all of us have a common collection. We all collect beliefs. And we have all been collecting beliefs all of our lives, since childhood, since infancy, really. And over the years, we've assembled quite a collection. But consequently, some of our beliefs are grown up. They're mature. They're sensible and rational and, well, adult. But other beliefs that we have, well, they're childish, even infantile, certainly immature and juvenile. But whether they are mature or childish, whether the individual belief is sensible or infantile, all of our beliefs play exactly the same important function in our lives. You know what our beliefs are, really? Our beliefs are our translators. They are life's interpreters for us. Did you ever see, maybe on TV, a meeting of the United Nations General Assembly? It's this big, big room, just full of people, dignitaries, representatives from almost every country in the world. And all those people, when the General Assembly is being addressed, they're all gathered in this big room. They're all looking at the person standing at the podium. They all appear to be listening to that person addressing the General Assembly. But in point of fact, that's not exactly what's happening at all. Very few people are actually listening to the individual that's addressing the representatives of the member nation. Now, almost everyone in that room is listening to a different voice and language entirely. They don't hear the speaker or his native tongue. What they're hearing is the voice of a translator speaking in a language they can understand through the earpiece they're all wearing on their ears. Well, can you imagine the problems a bad translator could cause at the United Nations? Do you ever think about that? I mean, don't you hope they have really good translators? Don't you hope none of them just gets it in their head to just kind of act up? Wouldn't that be a terrible thing? Think of the conflict that could result, and not just in that assembly room, but in the world, if you had a translator at the United Nations who was up to no good. I remember years ago in the old Monty Python Flying Circus comedy, from Great Britain, they had a skit one time about this ne'er-do-well that had translated a, I believe it was a Bulgarian-English dictionary for travelers, and translated things in the most outlandish ways that caused people to say very embarrassing things and outrageous things and get in fights because they were saying just awful things to each other, thinking they were saying something else entirely. Or haven't you ever gone to maybe a dubbed movie that wasn't very good, and what was being said didn't match the way the person's lips moved, and often the person's lips would continue to move for some time after the voice stopped, and you thought, is that what they're really saying? I have a friend who is not a particular fan of Jerry Lewis, the comedian, who believes the reason why Jerry Lewis is so popular in France is because whoever translated his moves into France must have been really funny. That's the only explanation John's ever been able to come up with. Or have you ever seen an interview where some foreign despot or dictator is speaking, and he goes on and on and on in some language you don't understand, and then the translator said, the premier said no. And you think, yeah, it sure looked like he said a lot more than that, didn't it? Looked like he must have said much more than that. Translation can be tricky, and that job is the job of our beliefs. And some of that job, sometimes that job is performed by a grown-up, but sometimes it's performed by beliefs that are childish. But our beliefs always are at work, translating whatever happens to us. And they are what communicates with our feelings, which is why our beliefs are really so powerful and so hard to deal with sometimes. Because our beliefs don't really speak directly to our intellect, to our reasoning faculty that could analyze them and think, well, you know, maybe this is a little challenge. Maybe I need to question it. No. Our beliefs whisper to our feelings, to our emotions. And our emotions, in turn, determine how we're going to act or react, determine whether what happened is going to make us feel pessimistic or optimistic, whether what we do in response to what happened is going to make us overcome or be overcome, succeed or fail. What we do is the result of how we feel. And if what the person said or did, or if what happens hurts our feelings, makes us feel mad or sad or bad about ourselves, we will respond in a way that is appropriate to that feeling most of the time. But is what we feel really appropriate? Is what we feel appropriate to what was actually said, or just appropriate to our belief's interpretation of what was said? Our belief's translation of what was said. Is our belief true? I mean, we certainly believe it. It is a belief, after all. But is it true? I mean, presumably at the United Nations, they screen those people. You know, I would assume at the United Nations they do background checks on their interpreters. But what about you and me? Do we ever take the time to screen or check out our beliefs for their accuracy or their appropriateness? I mean, some of them would pass the test. They'd pass the background check. Some of our beliefs, as I said, they are quite mature. They're factual. They are based on truths with a capital T. Truths that are as universal and reliable as the principles of mathematics or geometry. Truths that aspire even to the very truth of God. But many of our beliefs, they're juvenile, they're relative, and they're purely cultural. And these beliefs can cause a lot of misunderstandings because we treat them all as though they were absolutes. Well, let me give you a couple simple examples. I've used a couple of these before. These are examples of beliefs we learned in our society before, some of us before we could even talk. We learned these beliefs. In our society, we learned at a very early age, and for a lot of us, this was one of the first things we learned. We learned a certain gesture that means bye-bye. Bye-bye. We wave our hand in a certain way, and in our society, it means bye-bye. We learned another gesture early on, maybe even before we could speak. It means come here. Come here. We know the difference between those two. And we think that everyone would understand if we waved bye-bye or motioned, come here. And everyone in our culture would. But not everyone in the world. You know, in parts of Southeast Asia, our gesture for bye-bye, it means come here. And our gesture for come here, it means goodbye. My wife, Faye, learned this the hard way. For years, she taught people to speak English, and she was the director of adult programs at this one school. And she had a student from Southeast Asia, and he was leaving the campus, and she saw him, and She waved goodbye to him, just trying to be friendly to her student, and he came over to her. Wanted to know what she wanted. And she said, well, I just wanted to say goodbye. The student gave her a funny look and walked away sheepishly and got to the edge of campus and looked back and faced on. So I'm in one. Goodbye. And he came back over again. Now, fortunately, Faye had been teaching language for a long, long time and understood right away that something was wrong here. There's a problem with communication. But Faye didn't know that these gestures weren't universal. We just assume that what we believe, everyone believes. And I wonder if we might have some other beliefs. Might have some other beliefs that keep us from knowing whether we're coming or going also. Or another belief. In our society, we learned at an early age another gesture. We learned that if we nod our heads up and down, that means yes, and side to side means no. But that's not universal. We think it is. But if you travel to where my grandmother's people came from, to Eastern Europe, if you go to Hungary, if you visit Prague or Budapest, or maybe the Dalmatian coast, you'll find a lot of places there. It's just the reverse. Shaking your head side to side means yes. Shaking your head up and down means no. Can you imagine the difficulty you could have if, say, you're at a restaurant and they ask if you want more and you shake your head up and down and they walk away? Can you imagine how you might feel about that waiter? Well, he's not getting a tip. I wanted more. Or if they wanted to put some more paprika on it and the paprika was already, about to burn a hole in your stomach and you shook your head, no, I don't want any more paprika, and they just poured more of that stuff on till you thought your entire body would turn orange. And you would think, what are these people trying? Are these people trying to kill me? And maybe there are other beliefs we have that make us take no for an answer when what the other person really means is yes. Or let's make it even simpler. Has anyone ever accused you of being childish in your response to something someone said or did? Oh, you're being childish. Or maybe you said that to someone else because of their emotional response to something that happened, to something you said or someone did. Don't be childish, you said. Perhaps that's exactly what we were being. Perhaps we were using a belief that is indeed childish. But it's just part of the collection. And we don't bring out part of the collection, we just bring out the whole thing as we go through life. We never want to get rid of any part of that collection. Just think. Think of the stink there was just a few days ago when that air traffic controller brought his little child to work. Now, if you listen to the tapes, it's pretty obvious that the kid is sitting on his dad's lap. He's not really being allowed to land airplanes. In fact, I even got the impression that he might have been talking to pilots his father knew, because they all seemed pretty receptive to the idea. One of the pilots even said, I wish my little boy could come to work with me. Wouldn't that be a good idea? I think that might have been poor judgment on the part of the air traffic controller. However, he had adult supervision. His dad was obviously telling him what to say on the microphone. But a lot of our childish beliefs, they have no supervision. They have no adult supervision. They are acting like the supervisor, and they are in the control tower. And they are directing the flights, and they are sometimes causing our life to crash and burn. So what do we do? Well, according to Ellis, if if the A, activating events, are adversities we face in life, A can stand for adversities, are adversaries, competitors that we meet up with in life, seem to be eliciting from our B belief system a feeling response in C consequence that is, well, hurting us, holding us back, causing difficulties, then you know what you have to do? You have to dispute it. Dispute that belief, whether it has validity. You need, in other words, to do a background check. You need to do a little screening on the beliefs. But which beliefs need to be screened? Which beliefs don't pass the background check and need to be disputed? How can we identify the ones that need to be questioned and ones that are based on truth? Ones beliefs that are based on truths are beliefs that are just beliefs and perhaps infantile or, to borrow from the title of Wayne Dyer's old books, erroneous beliefs. Well, I would say let Scripture be your guide. For example, we're looking for what beliefs are based on truth. Jesus said the one way to identify truth is simple. It liberates you. Knowing the truth makes you free. And that's really the story of the Bible. That's the Old Testament too. Liberation from the house of bondage into the land of freedom. That's the story of the whole Bible, cover to cover. A story of liberation. Okay, is this feeling I'm feeling, recognizing that even though I might not have seen it happen, a belief is what's triggering the feeling. Our belief is what's interpreting what happened and telling me how to feel. Is the feeling I'm feeling one of being liberated? Am I feeling freer about this person or this event? Or am I feeling like a weight's been put? Am I feeling like a weight has been lifted? Or like a weight has been put on my shoulders? Am I feeling like a door has been opened or slammed in my face? Am I feeling opened up or shut down? Am I feeling, in other words, optimistic or pessimistic, positive or negative, in bondage or liberated? How am I feeling? If I'm feeling free, like the doors are opening, that's based on truth. If I'm feeling closed, shut down, the door slammed in my face, the barrier's been put up, I need to look at my belief about that situation, because maybe it's not based on truth. All right, here's another. 1 John tells us God is love, spells it out. Jesus tells us, and by the way, he's quoting Deuteronomy here, so this is a teaching of the New Testament and the Old. Jesus tells us the great commandment is to love God with all that we have and are, and to love our neighbor as and as well as ourselves. Is the way you're responding to this situation, to what was said or done or happened, loving? Does it make you love yourself more? Or does it make you feel like I just hate myself? Does it make you feel love toward the other people involved? Or does it make you feel another way? Not loving. Somebody might ask, well, I don't know. How would I feel loving toward adversity, toward an adversary? Well, we feel loving. Love is our natural reaction to adversity. What happened when you first heard about what happened in Haiti? Or more recently, what happened in Chile? Or before that, what happened with Katrina? Or in the tsunami? The normal knee-jerk reaction is to want to help. Even if you didn't know how, our normal knee-jerk reaction is to want to help with no thought of getting anything in return. In other words, to love unconditionally. That is our normal reaction to any adversity. Does it make me feel like I live in a universe created and sustained by a loving God? Well, maybe adversity doesn't make you think of that at first, but wait a minute. I find many people at least, don't discover the reality of a loving God, of a power higher than themselves, unless they're facing adversity. You show me somebody in the Bible that found God without adversity. There isn't anybody in there. None of them. It's always through adversity that they discover God's love. And pretty much that's how it works in our lives, too. Face it, when things aren't adverse, we don't think we need God. You know, our opinion when things aren't adverse is, well, yeah, it's okay, God, I'm doing fine. I'll call you if I need you. I'll call you if I need you. That's generally our attitude toward God. So does it make you feel love? Does it make you feel like there's a loving God? If it does it make you love yourself more? Well, if that's the way you're feeling, then your response, your belief that is interpreting the activating event, that's probably based on truth. And if it makes you feel some other way, not so much. And finally, and most simply, does this feeling I'm feeling, which remember is an interpretation of what happened, not what happened, does this feeling I'm feeling, one that I would characterize as giving me greater understanding or making me feel better understood? Or am I feeling like we're having a misunderstanding? How am I feeling? Because you know what? If it's a misunderstanding, if I'm feeling like I'm misunderstood, it sounds like something's being lost in translation to me. Let's pray about this. And to center ourselves for our experience of God in prayer, let us know that God is real, God is here, and God is the one and only power in our lives. Truly, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in our lives. God the good. Omnipotent. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God the good, omnipotent, and so it is.